Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate all our listeners coming in today to listen for another episode of Midrats. And if you're with that wonderful group of people that is actually with us live, if you'd like to scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the link that will take you to the chat room. That's a place to share your observations during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, and it doesn't look like we're quite going there, go ahead and put it in the chat room. We'll be looking at it, and we'll be glad to steal your ideas and claim them as our own. And if you got to run off and take care of some business and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if you want to get some of the previous episodes of Midrats, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take the shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And let's go ahead and dive into the show. And what's interesting is I realized as I was getting my paperwork ready here, as I mentioned in the intro, 2030 is actually pretty closer than what you think it is. It is only 13 years, and ironically, it's the same distance from 2004 to now, which is when I actually started writing online. Time travels very fast, and there are various ways you can grow and you can maintain a Navy, and when we look at China, a lot of times people's either prejudices or perspective might be based on a view of a certain time and place that might not be applicable to the now and definitely not into the near future as China and their Navy continue to build as their economy and their general stance in the world goes back to what is closer to a more historical place in their power structure. And our guest today is focused mostly on China's maritime growth is going to be Dr. Patrick Cronin. He is the senior advisor and also the senior director at the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for New American Security. Previously, he was the senior director of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, where he simultaneously oversaw the Center for the Study of Chinese Military Affairs. And for those that have seen the online advertisements, for lack of phrase for today's show, or you're with us on the chat room, we'll go ahead and put a link to as kind of a starting point and a touchstone for our discussion is going to be a recent CNAS publication where Dr. Cronin led the point on Beyond the Shanghai, the Challenge of China's Blue Water Navy. Patrick, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
And I guess to kick things off for those that have had a chance to read the work y'all put together, and I do highly recommend everybody grab hold of it. You early on brought up an interesting concept that I think could be very helpful for people as they start to think about China as they continue to take their place on the world scene. And it's a point of view of moving from talking about a rising China to what do you do with a risen China. If you could take a second about how you see that mindset and that perspective is different one to the other.
Well, I think it's amply clear in Asia today that China is on the rise and has risen at the same time. And in fact, many in Asia are discounting the United States quite rapidly the way they were discounting America back during the 2008 financial crisis. That ended up to be a premature discount of American power, but nonetheless, we really have China on the global stage. We saw Xi Jinping at the Davos annual meeting of leaders at the beginning of China will be the protector of the global economy. And we see the summit of the One Belt, One Road initiative that Xi Jinping just hosted last month in Beijing. And we also see Chinese leaders castigating the Americans for pulling out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement and essentially claiming that China's the new sort of global leader. That's, again, wildly premature, but it does highlight the fact that China's really gone a long way in a very short period of time. So on the military front and on the naval front, it wasn't very long ago that I listened to U.S. admirals, including former defense attachés in Beijing, jokingly refer to the Chinese Navy as doing the million-man swim in a reference to how they would have to invade Taiwan in a cross-strait scenario. They didn't really have the ability to even project power right there offshore inside the East and South China Seas. They have now clearly realized the dream of the late Admiral Liu Huaqing, who decades ago, back in a very army-dominated PLA, People's Liberation Army, was talking about the need to become a blue water navy and to project maritime power and sea power so that over a series of decades, China could gain sea control around their Shanghai, the three seas, the Yellow Sea, the East China Sea, and the South China Sea. And then by 2020, they could become really a regional force to project power and help deny access all the way out to the second island chain, out to Guam and the Marianas, and really start to project power globally through aircraft carrier battle groups. And by the middle of this century, the period now that Xi Jinping is referring to as achieving the so-called great rejuvenation of China, China would be a global power on a par with anybody. It would be the number one power within these near seas, and it would be regularly conducting operations in multiple oceans, including the Indian Ocean region, as well as the Western Pacific. So this is no longer a China that can be dismissed. This is a China that has risen. We've seen ample intelligence estimates from the U.S. government about the trajectory that China remains on. Even with the slowdown of the growth of the economy continues to grow at still a very healthy clip at the moment. And the National Intelligence Council, in an earlier projection, talked about how China led Asian growth, including India and other Asian powers too. By 2030, Asia would surpass not just the United States, but the United States and Europe when measured by the gross domestic product, so the economic wealth, but also the population, the military spending, and the research and development spending. And when you put those factors together, you can see how China is really leading this extraordinarily important shift in global power in a relatively short period of time. It has profound implications, obviously, for the U.S. Navy, for American power, for American strategic influence.
One of the things about the I'm not sure what to call it, but the work that we're talking about, this piece you did for CNS, is you mentioned what I think was a Maoist term called active defense. How much of what we're seeing from the way China is approaching developing a blue water navy and their South China Sea efforts is part of that active defense, and what does that mean in terms of the rest of the world?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that really deserves even more comprehensive discussion than just one radio show. Certainly, China's active defense has been fully adopted over the last 15 years or so in the maritime space, and it is it's no longer sitting on its heels waiting to react. It's literally going out and incrementally changing the status quo, and this is something that Secretary of Defense Mattis at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore this weekend chided the Chinese for blatantly violating the rule of law and said that the United States would not accept coercive unilateral changes of the status quo. That's a formulation that more or less has been U.S. policy for some time, but the Chinese are no longer deterred by American power, and they're no longer deterred by regional pressure or institutions in any significant way. And we've seen this in the last 3 years through this unprecedented reclamation and island building in the Spratly Islands, the island group in the southernmost portion, essentially, of the South China Sea, and the fortification of these islands, even though Xi Jinping had talked on an earlier trip to the United States to see then-President Obama, she had pledged not to militarize the South China Sea. And here, China's very much leaning forward, and that didn't stop the Chinese participants at the Shangri-La Dialogue this weekend from having the chutzpah to talk about how the United States was creating trouble by conducting a freedom of navigation operation recently around one of those islets, Mischief Reef, which is a naturally low-tide elevation. It's a rock, in other words, and it's not entitled to any territorial sea protection under international law. And the fact that the United States has not ratified the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is what the Chinese participant chided the U.S. for, really is irrelevant because the issue is what China's doing and what China has done with these islands. So active defense is they're incrementally building out a larger strategic space. And this space is much larger than their sovereign space. So while the Chinese love to talk about indisputable territory and indisputable history of owning the South China Sea, which is actually very much in dispute, they are at the same time through dual-use measures, including civilian ports in the Indian Ocean, huge investments in Pakistan, their very first overseas military base in Djibouti, which they had always forsworn military bases overseas, said they would never have them, that this was an act of imperialism. And here they have built a very large base that coincides with an effective resource extraction and port facility, which shows just how they're blurring the line between their sea lines of communication, their economic lines of the economy with resources pouring in all the way from Africa, from the Persian Gulf, and throughout Asia, and they're securitizing them. They're basically building up these dual-use facilities and actively going on the defensive to protect them. And when you think about China spending, as they are right now, $55 billion in very weakly governed Pakistan, and I say it has a strong government, of course, and military, but it has a weak, effective governance structure. They're building, through $55 billion of investment, they're going to build a huge economic corridor that connects their port in Gwadar, which gives them access closer to the Persian Gulf, all the way up in through toward China. And they're going to have to secure that, and that means they're going to be placing more and more PLA officers overseas, and they're going to be using their PLA Navy and other sea power and maritime and military power assets to protect the lines of communication. And that's effectively one of the means by which they will grow this strategic space, which could, as their capabilities grow, could lead to changed intentions. And so they could go from an active defense to an active offense. And that's one of the long-term concerns about China's power projection capability. But in our report, which was done with our Asia team, with Dr. Mira Rapp Hooper and Harry Kresa, Alex Sullivan, and Rush Dosi, we looked at how this far seas capability that China's been building and will really have gone and advanced significantly in the 2020 period, really changes profoundly the primacy of China's maritime power vis-a-vis its neighbors. So there is no peer to the PLA Navy among Asian navies within the next couple of years. Even Japan is being eclipsed by the sheer quantity of the PLA Navy, and increasingly China is closing the quality between that historically they've lacked in military hardware. They're rapidly closing that. So even this year, 2017, if we look at the numbers in our report, We don't include all of the ships in the order battle because we deliberately exclude logistic ships, other support ships, and even amphibious ships, but only to show that over time, since the beginning of this century to last year to out to 2030, that the PLA Navy has essentially now at the tip. It's at the tipping point of surpassing capital ships of the United States Navy, and when you put that into the context of East Asia, the Pacific, and even the Indian Ocean, it's magnified because China has huge geographical land positioning from which to project that power. The United States has global responsibilities, and its allies are more limited. So China's strategy, and we can talk about strategy, and maybe I should at this point digress and just talk a little bit about, from a U.S. perspective, you know, what are we talking about with strategy, because there are at least two fundamentally different ways to think about strategy, and I think a lot of the listeners on this show probably adhere to the fairly traditional military definition of strategy, the art of distributing and applying military means to fulfill the ends of policy is what Littlehart or Hugh Strawn would say. That it's literally trying to achieve political ends through military means and keeping it fairly tightly focused on that relationship between military means achieving those Clausewitzian political ends. But there is another definition of strategy, and it's really one that I think is closer to what the Chinese Communist Party is pursuing here, and really it also speaks, I think, to U.S. national policy and strategy, and that's the art of creating power, as Lawrence Friedman calls it in his sort of magnum opus book on strategy. It's essentially trying to advance your strategic influence, and there's where China is doing a much better job, at least in 2017, of alternating this growing incremental assertions of sovereignty in places like the South China Sea and East China Sea, even on the Korean Peninsula, by vetoing effectively or at least putting pressure on the South Korean government over a missile defense deployment, among other things. It's incrementally increasing its strategic influence with some hard power, and then it's mixing in immediately the tantalizing promise of infrastructure, of capital investment through the Belt Road Initiative and through other economic investments and inducements. And this was on this is something the United States, if it just goes into the Asian region to try to play the hard power game, of which it needs more effective hard power because it's being compromised by China's growth, it's going to lose that strategy because that strategic influence of the economic carrots of China are just very tempting, and the United States needs a more comprehensive strategy as well. So we can look at this from the broader comprehensive, maybe grand perspective, and we can look at it from the military strategy perspective. But either way, the growth of China's maritime strategy, backed by other capabilities, by the way, their capabilities in outer space and cyberspace, but especially the newly developed and separate PLA rocket force, which is the force that really provides the great equalizer of threatening our capital ships if they do approach even within inside the second island chain, but especially inside the first island chain, it gives China a long threat that no sort of naval captain in the United States Navy, at least, can ignore the increasing envelope coverage of these Chinese missiles. And when they put to sea, of course, or when they're potentially put on these islets in the South China Sea, you start to see the reach go well beyond even, you know, to the second island chain and beyond. And this gives the Chinese enormous conventional reach, and they don't have to actually use this power for it to be effective. It's sending messages even right now to the region again that essentially it's trying to send the narrative that China is inevitably the principal and dominant military power in the region, and secondly, the United States is on its way down and out. Now, we have to counter that narrative, but many steps have to go into that, and that gets into a whole set of recommendations.
You know, the libraries are full of examples of nations who stumble into conflict because one party or the other one projects their own preconceived notions or their own mental habits onto the others. It misinterprets or misassigns actions being one thing or another. And when you look at, besides a few opportunities of tripping over each other in the South China Sea or something happening with the disputed islands from Japan all the way through Vietnam, that on a global scale, as Chinese maritime capabilities grow into a blue water, you can actually in many ways see more opportunities for cooperation vice conflict. But it's also raised in the work that you produced with your team that whereas the U.S. is at a point where we are relatively risk adverse, the Chinese, as they grow, and you outlined a little bit with their investment in Pakistan and in other places, they have more of a risk acceptance view and posture. Are there some areas where you see that we might get caught flat-footed or misinterpret something based simply because our assumptions are what they are and we don't fully appreciate what the Chinese habit or developing habit of being more risk acceptance leads them to do something that we might not be quite ready to respond to?
Well, again, another good question. It just reminds us that we have to always be doing our due diligence and keep an open mind and be careful about our own assumptions. You know, a couple of the books that I've really enjoyed reading and catching up with lately are by a blind historian who's out at the Naval Postgraduate School, Zachary Shore. Zach is, in fact, coming to our annual conference on the 28th. I've got him on a panel with Graham Allison. We're going to, and Toshi Yoshihara and Jim Dreyer, and we're going to talk about the possibility of war in Asia, including the thesis of Graham Allison, the Harvard professor's new book on the Thucydides trap, who in that book he argues that he looks at the fact that previous power transitions in the major powers of the international system have led to war 3 out of 4 times. It's a very spurious number in my view, but the point is there are dangers, and it's just impossible to put a number on it, I think. The thing that Zach Shore warns us about is the need to develop strategic empathy, the real need to get inside the head. I mean, it's know your enemy, know yourself. I mean, Sun Tzu said the same thing, but this is something that we have sometimes done well. In Jack Shore's excellent book called A Sense of the Enemy, for instance, he asked the question, you know, why did Franklin Roosevelt get Hitler pegged right and Stalin not? you know, why was Stalin taken by surprise? And so, he has a number of guidelines for how to detect pattern breaks in potential adversaries. And it's something. It's certainly on my mind on this day, June 4th. This is the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Midway, of course, when the United States caught the Japanese fleet and delivered that important blow that showed the Japanese were not invincible. We sunk, I think, 4 carriers and more than 300 aircraft. And it was a real turning point that 2 years later, this month, again, June of 1944, we were fighting our way back into the Marianas. And that Marianas campaign, taking Guam and Tinian and Saipan, that was fighting our way back inside the second island chain to get to the first island chain and take the fight to the enemy. We are, for the very first time since then, faced with the prospect that we may have to fight our way back inside the second island chain to take on the protection of an ally or a partner or to otherwise try to deal with the Chinese. And there's a real risk that in so doing, we could escalate. And assumptions about short wars or wars going, you know, staying conventional and not going to the nuclear level, the idea that we would definitely win the war, I think all of those assumptions are probably need to be considered specious as well. I mean, that, you know, we just don't know. I think there's too much uncertainty in all of these scenarios. And that's why there, in my view, because we are two major nuclear powers, China and the United States, we are really in a bounded competition with China. And that bounded competition is one that former governments and the administrations of the United States have talked about advancing cooperation with China and maximizing that, and then at the same time trying to hedge and balance against the more competitive elements of the competition with China. So we're simultaneously in a period of trying to grow trade and cooperation with China and build confidence-building measures and to build in measures for avoiding escalation. Our navies have gotten together to try to do exactly that, to try to have an incidents at sea type process, as we did with the Soviet Union with Russia today, in order to avoid an inadvertent collision or escalation. At the same time, that's not a sufficient strategy. That's just a measure to try to limit inadvertent accident or escalation. The competition continues to go on, and if we're not taking that competition seriously, then we're definitely falling further behind, and we're losing strategic influence, and we're putting a lot of things we hold dear at risk. So within this bounded competition, I have argued that we can cooperate and compete at the same time, and in fact, we have to. But we do have to worry about the potential for escalation. I mean, Graham Allison, you know, didn't make up the point that sometimes in power transitions, it does lead to war. Secretary Mattis yesterday at the Shangri-La Dialogue said he doesn't believe this will lead to conflict. And I agree with Secretary Mattis, but just because it's not probable or even likely doesn't mean it's possible and that we shouldn't do some things to try to guard against it. So I'm in that middle ground of wanting to compete strongly with China, not concede areas that are near and dear to our interests in terms of freedom of the seas, in terms of order, access, and strategic influence. Those are the three qualitative goals of the United States that we've had since the beginning of the Republic, essentially. And we have a strong investment in open access to the global commons, including the maritime commons, in sustaining the order, especially the order that we helped to fight and win and build from out of the crucible of World War II, and then to maintain our strategic influence that we've had since then. And I think we can do all of those three things and not escalate to World War III with China, but we do have to be on our guard against escalation or that. China doesn't want to escalate to war either, but they are, as you said, more risk-acceptant in terms of knowing or thinking that they know that the United States is not likely to respond below certain thresholds or actions that they take. And they've taken full advantage of our threshold for responding to a military crisis. So a lot of people wondered whether the second Thomas Shoal incident or the Scarborough Shoal incident, when you're dealing with both dealing with the Philippines, the United States might actually muscle its way in. And indeed, when Secretary of State Tillerson was still just going through the nomination hearing process, he alarmed a lot in the region and in China, certainly, by talking about the need for the United States possibly to sort of force our way back in and using force on some of the islands. Of course, our Philippine ally under President Duterte has gone in a different direction from his predecessor, President Aquino. So under Aquino, we signed a new agreement for access and basing, essentially, and stepping up cooperation in the maritime domain. Duterte has played a much more uncertain, unpredictable balancing game working with China, Russia, but of late coming back to the United States and asking for support because he recognizes how exposed the Philippines are in terms of the South China Sea. So all of these types of small flashpoints and some of the historical enmity that exists throughout Asia could easily escalate into a local conflict. And the question is, would it drag in China and the United States into a real conflict? And at this point, one assumes not, because, again, there's this bounded competition and the interests clearly are on the side of limiting conflict. But unfortunately, knowing that it won't escalate also allows the Chinese to push the envelope more in terms of these creeping assertions of sovereignty. And this is, by the way, North Korea does the same thing through its provocations in terms of trying to kind of shift, move the goalposts and shift the negotiations as well by becoming, in this case, a de facto nuclear weapons state with longer range missiles, even while there's very little we can do to stop them and at an acceptable level, because North Korea knows that we don't want to start a major nuclear war. And there's that prospect. With China, it's a little more murky, because here we are having the harassment of even a nuclear sniffer aircraft, which is not an offensive aircraft at all, flying in the exclusive economic zone within 200 miles of the Chinese coastline, but outside of their territorial boundaries, their 12 nautical miles, and yet the Chinese came and harassed them with two aircraft just recently. And that it was a way for the Chinese to show some military muscle, to send the United States a signal that there will be no military operations inside their exclusive economic zone in the future without Chinese permission, which will not be given. And they did this knowing that the United States would not really respond with anything but verbiage or private discussion, especially at a time when China and the United States are trying to cooperate on North Korea. So you can see there are lots of ways, lots of seams in the relationship that can be exploited. And so far, China's had a much better offense for this kind of growing the strategic influence. It's not just the military contest that we're looking at. We're really looking at the strategic influence, and China's exploiting that to get stronger and to send a message to the region, again, that there is no peer. China's number one, and the United States is on its way out. And that's a message that China, almost every utterance I heard at the Shangri-La Dialogue, just reading through what the Chinese participants said, very little of it was would be taken seriously in Washington, but a lot of it was not, didn't really matter whether it was serious. It was still conveying the same kind of meta message that China's actually going to write the rules, and the United States system is increasingly a relic. And I think the United States will have to work comprehensively with others to make sure that is not the case. And I'm actually more optimistic than I sound right there. But I do see China's pursuit of this strategy on a regular basis. And I've been watching it, especially over the last decade, when you think about their Blue Water Navy sort of outreach, from beginning with the Gulf of Aden and the counter-piracy, where going back to an earlier point, this is an area where they're cooperating with the international system. So we're actually looking for China to cooperate. And out of area, out of the East and South China Sea and Yellow Sea areas, China's cooperation is a lot easier to fathom, because they're not a direct threat. And at the same time, they have some real needs, as they saw in Libya in 2011, they saw in Yemen more recently, the need to be able to evacuate especially Chinese nationals who are suddenly at risk in a conflict zone. And, of course, natural disasters, whether in the region or outside, China's role can be a very constructive role. And those are very good things, and we should be maximizing the cooperation. Of course, they also participate now and have been invited to a third Rim of the Pacific exercise next year. But that is not without controversy, because the concern that China picks up more intelligence and legitimacy than is helpful from simply including them in an exercise, especially given the fact that they have paved such vast swaths of the South China Sea in the last 3 years, and they haven't really been forced to pay a price.
Well, speaking of signaling, one of the recommendations in the paper was that we should be sending stronger signals. Can you kind of discuss the unannounced freedom of navigation operations and the recommendation for doing carrier ops in the South China Sea?
Yes, it is important for the United States to send clear, loud signals, not just to the Chinese, but for the region at large, to remind them that we are still the most capable naval power. We have strong interests in assured access to the maritime commons and global commons. We were not going to let the Chinese define the South China Sea as all China owned. That's not true to history. It's not right under international law, and we can go to last year's Permanent Court of Arbitration Tribunal ruling, which in almost all but one case basically said the whole nine-dash line claim to the vast majority of the South China Sea by China is not consistent with contemporary international law of UNCLOS. So we do need to send clear signals. The freedom of navigation operations get complex, and the government has a difficult time articulating what exactly it's doing, partly because it's using some of the ambiguity of what they're doing to mask the fact that we have multiple objectives. So one of the objectives is the main objective of freedom of navigation operations that we've been conducting globally after the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea was signed has been to just push back on excessive maritime claims. It took the Obama administration some time to start to take that seriously in terms of conducting operations. And instead of conducting a clear freedom of navigation operations, it conducted more innocent passage operations, which are not as threatening, certainly, but they're also not sending the same message, because innocent passage is a much lower demand of international law than freedom of navigation. The freedom of navigation is basically saying this is the high seas, whereas innocent passage is basically just saying we're not going to conduct any operations. We're just going through. We're just passing through. And so the reported man overboard exercise performed this past month outside of Mischief Reef, 6 miles off of Mischief Reef. Again, a low tide elevation naturally before it was built up. It's not entitled to a 12 nautical miles. So 6 miles away is far more than any safety zone. So it doesn't tell the Chinese that they don't occupy it. It just simply says these are international waters, and we can conduct operations in international waters, and that's what we did. It's very important to be able to do that on a regular basis, and sometimes backed by very significant hard power. And this is where the risk acceptance, risk aversion equation that was alluded to earlier becomes important. A carrier operation conveys our most muscular naval statement that we could possibly make, both to reassure the region that the United States is committed to access and order in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, in globally, and that at the same time, we're not going to be dissuaded just because the Chinese want to pretend that they can coerce the region. Again, so the words that Secretary Mattis used, that we will not accept coercive unilateral changes of the status quo, well, a way to signal that, that as fact is not simply talking about it, although that has to be done as well, and it's very important for the Secretary of Defense to go to the leading meeting every year of defense ministers and make that emphatically clear, even while we're seeking more cooperation with China on other issues, including North Korea. And then backing up by the Freedom of Navigation operation, which people were beginning to criticize the Trump administration for not having conducted one, and then they went ahead and did their first Freedom of Navigation operation, is a sign that, again, this is reflecting continuity in U.S. policy. This is longstanding U.S. policy. It's bipartisan. It's not a partisan issue. Should not be. But you do need to have the political will to put some muscle in it. And certainly the fact that we've had two and at one time maybe three aircraft carriers up around the Korean Peninsula this past week as the Carl Vinson gets replaced by the Ronald Reagan, I think we have very strong signaling going on around the Korean Peninsula. But we also need to be able to signal in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea very strong signals as well. Some of this is done with high-level visits and the fact that the Pacific Command Commander Harry Harris visited Yonaguni Island, for instance, very close to the Senkaku or the Diutai in the East China Sea, the islands that the Chinese have been putting pressure on Japan on since especially 2012, is also a high-level way to signal American commitment, American deterrence, and to reassure our ally, in this case Japan and the East China Sea, that we're committed to our treaty ally. And in the South China Sea, that we are also determined to thwart these coercive unilateral changes of the status quo. It doesn't mean we will stop every bit of reclamation or we're not going to recklessly try to instigate a conflict, but it means we're not going to be shy about putting serious hard power in the vicinity of an area where there are excessive claims being made. And so even regular periodic freedom of navigation operations backed by hard power made at the same time with clear articulations of policy that reflect continuity and are based on international law, these are the very strong sinews of an effective signaling strategy for the United States. Now, there's a regional diplomacy aspect of this that we also cannot ignore, however. This is not just the United States cannot want open access and order in Asia without other actors. And so it's very important, as the Philippines this year is in the chair of the Southeast Asian grouping, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, and the Philippines has been essentially doing more business with China as it tries to seek some significant investment from China. Duterte has been playing a kind of an open-ended balancing game with China and even Russia at the expense of the United States, but President Trump has kept his powder dry on the Philippines, had a very successful phone call, some would say maybe too successful phone call, that was leaked to the press recently. But the fact is that he, Trump and Duterte, seem of one mind on cooperation on the South China Sea. And this significantly strengthens the U.S. position to project power in the South China Sea and on behalf of and with an ally, in this case the Philippines, working with Vietnam, working with Indonesia, working with Singapore, working with countries that use these international shipping lanes, big maritime powers, Australia and India and Japan and Korea and others. So it is possible to build a very significant coalition of the majority behind a position that's based on the rule of law, and that's what the United States is trying to do. But it uniquely brings the muscle and the maritime power in terms of the South China Sea that is the only potential real counterweight to China's growing naval and sea power.
We alluded to it earlier on in the show, but on page 9 of the report is just a real eye-opening graphic that outlines from 2000, 2016 to 2030, the relative expected growth of the three navies, and not all, as you mentioned, not all ships, just your ballistic missile submarines, nuclear submarines, non-nuclear submarines, aircraft carriers, large and small surface combatants. And what's interesting is in that sway of time of 30 years from 2020 to 2030, when you just look at the U.S. numbers by themselves, we decrease in size in every category but large surface combatants. And at the end of the day, we still are aggregately larger in all areas but small surface combatants and non-nuclear submarines. But the economist in me kind of draws back and thinks about that's an incredible growth for the Chinese to make from an economic and an industrial sustainability standpoint. We have a lot of legacy capability here to at least sustain the fleet that we have. Does China have the maritime defense or dual-use infrastructure, not just to build up a fleet that large by 2030, but also to do the normal maintenance routines and availabilities that you would see on a regular basis for the ships already built?
The short answer is they might, but they also undoubtedly face many, many obstacles. You could just even have that same discussion on the future of the Chinese economy overall. In fact, I had it on Friday with a group of Chinese university graduate students who are in the United States studying this year, and they brought together an elite group of them for a week-long discussion in Washington. And talking about the future of the economy of China, the general vibe is that they think they will do more than muddle through and succeed, that they'll bring about the reforms that will help become engine still of a larger military, including achieving the Admiral Lu's Blue Water Navy vision. We'll see whether that really happens or not. We can't even predict the next few years or 5 or 10 years, so it's very hard to see. And at the same time, the military spending on the PLA Navy and on, by the way, the rest of their maritime power, much of which is in law enforcement and coast guards and even maritime militia and fishing and oil platforms, they are building a huge industrial structure. So we are hurting when it comes to our industrial base in terms of our shipbuilding industry in the United States relative to what China has. So we cannot replicate what was done the last time we had to fight our way back into the second and first island chain when we had that industrial capacity. So there is a profound difference. Now, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Richardson, recently released a very good, important white paper where he said, look, he's also committed to even more than 355 ships if we have current technology, but the reality is that alone, numbers alone, won't get us to where we want to go. It's really a combination of sustainable, innovative, and powerful force. Admiral Jim Stavridis has a brand new book on sea power, and he talks about the need for the United States to focus especially on both power projection and sea control capabilities. And I think that's where our ability to win undersea, the ability to win in cyberspace and through intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, the ability to have distributed fires to project power from any platforms. I mean, all of these are going to be ways that we can spend the Chinese short as well. So not only will they have trouble with their overextended Belt and Road Initiative and then trying to secure that Belt and Road Initiative or then trying to convert their newfound military and maritime power into regional hegemony and regional control, they will also face a growing network of U.S. and U.S. allies and partners with their own anti-access area denial type capabilities that can both raise the costs on China and make them unsustainable, but also make the Chinese have their own, what Dan Blumenthal has called, their own unsafe zones, their own points of vulnerability, including in their critical choke points, because they do have a geography that essentially forces them to travel through very narrow choke points, and those are points of vulnerability. So from the social and political to the industrial and economic to the military, China's got enormous obstacles, but they also have some major things going for them right now. One, they have certainly the perception that their time is still coming and that they are on the rise. They have a strong internal belief that they have finally are reaching this great rejuvenation, and Xi Jinping is heading toward a party Congress later this year with that sort of mantra. A couple of recent books that just came out that are excellent history books on China. I mean, one of them by the journalist Howard French, Everything Under the Heavens, but the British historian Robert Bickers, a book called Out of China, just published in the UK, very much looks at how the whole driver for China's outreach, including in its maritime domain, is really the history. It's the history, the century of humiliation, but it's the Chinese version of that. So not only did they evict everybody from and get them out of China from their perspective, and finally they've risen, but now they have the maritime and military and economic power, and the world stage, really the political power too, to to go out and create new rules and to create a more Sinocentric system, and they are really feeling that. Is that a vast exaggeration and overextension? Very possibly, but we don't know the answer to that. In the meantime, the United States is at risk of sort of losing not just power in perception, but losing out in terms of the strategic influence and even the ability to project power and have sea control in very critical geostrategic space around Asia.
You know, I keep talking about the second island chain. As a former resident of the territory of Guam and a person familiar with the Commonwealth, U.S. Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands, I'm a little concerned about how blasé we tend to be about talking about the second island chain. That is U.S. territory, the Marianas, and I'm a little concerned that we're just kind of, well, you know, that the Chinese are just saying that's part of their world too, I guess. And I'm a little, is it wrong for me to be upset that they look at it that way?
I think it's very important to remind all Americans that this is U.S. territory. It's one of the reasons why we are a permanent resident Pacific power. But just because we are a resident doesn't mean we have power if we don't use it. And if we take it for granted, we will lose it again. It's extraordinarily valuable positioning inside Asia Pacific. I have brought top analysts from throughout the region to Guam to do a workshop just in order to let them know how the United States is present in the region. We're in the same time zone, and we have the ability to conduct training, exercising, and can cooperate region-wide or with smaller groups. And we can do this right here in U.S. territory in the region. We don't have to even go back to Hawaii or to the west coast of the United States. So it shouldn't be assumed, and the fact that the Chinese can dangle millions of dollars in money to sort of with a new casino and threaten the basing of the United States in the Marianas is an ongoing real problem. Because if you're a local politician and you're looking for massive investment that could bring in lots of Chinese tourists, it's very hard to say no, just because you're supposed to be supporting the long-term strategic security of the United States. So we have to be very much on our guard in the Marianas, and we can't just do this. But if you think about the new laydown with the Marine Corps and the movement of 5,000 troops out of Okinawa that's been long in the books and is supposed to be done in the 2020s, there's a certain lack of seriousness about that enterprise that concerns me personally, that we don't really seem to be certain about our future basing structure in the region, even while the Japanese are paying a very good bit of money to try to expedite it and keep it on track, partly to lower the footprint in Okinawa of U.S. troops, but also to keep the United States very much anchored in the region, and including in facilities that Japan and Australia and regional countries can come and also work with the United States. And I think these are very important investments that we need to take very seriously. I'm never going to get a standing ovation from vast American audiences on that issue, but I mean the people who take care of our national security and defense issue have to take our position in Guam and the Marianas very seriously.
As we get back to the last 5 minutes of the show, man, what a fast hour. Just for the listener, you know, there are certain points where, and you know, to use, lack of a better phrase, a certain tipping point where a rising nation's navy really becomes blue water, more than just a token force. You know, on the American side of the house, some people call, you know, the Great White Fleet. Sometimes some people draw the line at the end of World War I, where it became apparent in size and economic might and direction that was the point for the U.S. But what are some of the things you think the listeners should watch, keep an eye open for, that will really be a defining tipping point for the risen China's established place on the global seas?
Well, there is a whole classification system that people use to classify what what constitutes an inland waterway navy versus an inshore constabulary navy to a regional offshore coastal defense. And we've just seen China move from this coastal defense to becoming a regional navy with power projection to right on the cusp of being able to project power into oceans. And I think that's the next test, is will China really be able to conduct effective operations, even for a non-combatant evacuation, but maybe for supporting an actual military operation in the Indian Ocean region or throughout the Asia Pacific. And I think certainly by 2030, we're going to be watching closely the development of what could be four carrier battle groups. Right now, they've just put their second aircraft carrier, their first indigenously built aircraft carrier has been commissioned and put at sea off of Qingdao and for some initial tests. And we were very impressed with how the Liaoning, while not an effective carrier per se, it's basically the knockoff of the Kuznetsov old Russian carrier that they bought from Ukraine. But at the same time, they managed to put it out to sea for operations at a much faster pace than we ever expected. So watching, I think, the pace at which the Chinese and the PLA Navy in particular deploys the second carrier, the indigenous carrier, and moves forward with the third aircraft carrier, although those are largely still symbolic platforms, I think they become very important symbols for how seriously China takes gaining positive military control over the Shanghai, over the three seas, from their perspective. And I think this is a march that they've long been planning, if you think about Admiral Liu's vision, and they're finally, over the next decade, really on the cusp of realizing it. The other part of this to watch, of course, is to what extent the United States is able to act on its own well-debated and known need for an effectively sized and capable Navy, including with enough submarines and ASW and C4ISR and long-range sort of power projection. It's part of the administration's policy. My colleague Jerry Hendricks has written, among many others, have written about how to try to achieve it. I had the privilege of privately talking with Richard Spencer, the man who's been nominated to be Secretary of the Navy, and I'm very impressed with his focus on what he knows to be the need to have an effective maritime hammer, and to focus on the things that Jim Stavridis writes about in his new book, Sea Power, the need for our power projection and our sea control capabilities. So watching what the Chinese do with their long-range blue water Navy capabilities, watching what we do as well with our clear needs to recapitalize and innovate at the same time with our Navy, and then thirdly, probably watching the potential fortification and buildup in the South China Sea. If China actually emplaces missiles on the Spratly islets, the artificial islands that they built up at Subi Reef and Mischief Reef and Fiery Cross Reef, if they do start to really project power to the southern portion of the South China Sea, then I think that's another indicator that they really are serious about blocking the United States, including blocking the United States from supporting Taiwan, for instance, in a scenario where Beijing may coerce Taipei and leave Taiwan at the mercy of whatever the Chinese want, rather than what happened in the mid-1990s when the United States steamed near the Cross Strait area and very much demonstrated strong support for Taiwan not to be coerced by the mainland.
Pat, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today. We've been discussing, or sort of the basis for our discussion was a report that CNAS prepared called Beyond the Shanghai, the Challenge of China's Blue Water Navy. What have you got going on for the near future, and where can our listeners pick up more information about what you're up to and on this topic?
Yes, and it's a great Asia team report, the Beyond the Sound High, and you can get a copy by emailing me or downloading it. It's all available at the cnas.org website. Our next report, which we'll release next month, or actually later this month, I'm sorry, we're in June, is going to look at network security. So among the many responses that the United States can pursue to try to preserve strategic influence and to try to preserve order and open access in the global commons and the maritime commons is to ride this wave of networked, looser, bilateral and minilateral, like trilateral and quadrilateral security cooperation arrangements, not all of which the U.S. Is leading or taking part in, but we can certainly give support. So when Japan and Australia cooperate, or when Japan, Australia, and the United States conduct exercises or military cooperation, that's just one of many illustrations of sort of a trend in the region. And that report will be out I think, the 21st of the month. And then finally, at our June 28th annual conference, we'll be hosting a panel discussion that I put together that I mentioned on whether there will be war in Asia. And if so, it's not just war between China and the United States that is a concern. It's obviously war over the Korean Peninsula. It could be war over historical rivalry. Think about Japan and China. It could be another type of conflict. But why will war happen or not happen? And looking at it from the perspective of historians and from military planners or from regional specialists, thinking through different levels of analysis. So those are on tap for the month of June.
And thank you very much. Greatly appreciate you taking time, and y'all doing some great work over there. It keeps us all busy and interested. And I hope you have a great rest of the summer, Patrick.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Yes, sir. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Mike Maloney wants to marry me and